all going to be pissed and you're going to be fine.
We'll call the Senate Taxes Committee to order.
Yes, they just went to hell.
Esther's not here. Should we just start with Boone and then? Should we start? I think we're going to wait for Senator Rest to do Senate File 119. So let's start with Senate File 349, Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Mr. Chairman, should we move the bill or how do you want to handle this?
Senator Coonan, I think we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion and probably further discussion and work. What I would like, Senator Coonan, is for your testifiers to have, you know, relatively brief testimony to the committee. Perhaps we would hear from the department if they're around on their reaction to the issue of these tanks that are in ethanol plants, that there's discussion as to whether they're storage tanks or part of the process that's going forward. Perhaps a little discussion about how that interplays in the process or of your plants, get the department's response, and then I'm just going to lay this over for further discussion and possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I see on the testifiers list that Glenn Jacobson is listed from Renville County, who would have traveled a ways then. So if he could have a chance.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee, this bill is here because of a series of events that happened over the last few years in Renville County. Renville County and the sugar beet plant ended up in tax court, and then through a process of appeal ended up in further courts. But what happened was the court ruled that their storage tanks were taxable as real estate, and so this bill addresses that issue, that the Department of Revenue, in their guidance books after that court case, decided to include other tanks also, which would be like, for example, fermentation beer wells and liquefaction processing tanks, which were all exempt prior to this. And this would be for facilities like biofuel facilities, wineries, breweries, distilleries, dairy processing plants, and sometimes I wonder too if this might involve also feed mills, where they have tanks, they're mixer tanks they use for mixing feed. You know, I just don't know how far this could go, but we're trying to address that type of issue. I have a couple. Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, we're trying to address the guidance that Department of Revenue sent out to the counties on this, and this bill is, of course, a first step in that process. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing it. It needs work yet. I think that's right that it does. What the bill doesn't do is change anything that the court decided about the sugar beet tanks and silos at the sugar beet plant. It doesn't address that issue at all. And it also doesn't address the issue at these other facilities, if they have storage tanks, either for raw products coming in or finished product after the processing is done. So it doesn't affect those types of tanks. It's just the tanks that are used in the process, whatever it may be, biofuels, wineries, dairy processing, any of those, the tanks that are used in the actual working process of the products they're producing. So, and I do have a testifiers here, Mr. Chairman.
Who would you like to start first, Senator Coonan? Welcome to the Tax Committee, and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Timothy Rudnicki. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. What I'd like to do is briefly walk you through some legal policy issues, and then I'd like to turn it over to Don Gales, who's also at the table, to actually share with you some process issues, and we have a handout in color that will help us with that. So, first of all, the court tells us that the wisdom and social effects of tax provisions lie with the responsibility of the legislatures, not the courts. This is coming from the sugar beet case, which you just heard about. And the court also tells us the debate over the interpretation of a relevant provision of the statute should be waged at the legislature, not in the judicial branch. So what I'd like to cover briefly are three things. We are here because the current issue, based on the statute and the court case, is complicated, it's confusing based on current policies and practices, and it's very costly. So firstly, on the complication issue, the current tax statute basically says everything is taxable as real property unless it's specifically excluded. And then in 1985, the legislature added a provision which essentially created an exception to the exclusion. And the exception really is based on this notion of having walls, a device or a building having walls, floors, and a ceiling. And keep in mind that was 1985, long before the current ethanol industry you have before you has been operating. So therein is one element of the complication. And essentially, while some may say that everything is clear, all is clear, the court case answers all of our questions and problems, what the court case doesn't really wrestle with is the fact that the biofuel production industry deals with vessels or tanks. And some might argue they have ceilings, walls, and floor. I submit to you that perhaps pole barns are more likely in tune with what the legislature was dealing with in 1985, something with ceilings, roof, walls, and floor, not sophisticated containment vessels used to produce biofuels. So there's some tortured reasoning the court has to go through and that we continue to live under today. What's confusing? Well, if you are in the biofuel industry, you'll know there's a long history where these process tanks, fermentation tanks, beer wells, and liquefaction tanks actually have been treated as personal property. Long history of that. And there's even a 2009 assessor's manual, which explicitly calls out that exempt from real property are liquefaction tanks, fermentation tanks, and beer wells. No ambiguity there. Black and white, written, and it's guidance. Today, there is no written guidance that we are aware of that would direct county assessors to specifically reclassify personal property process tanks as real property. Finally, litigation, costly. So it's complicated, confusing, and costly. Millions of dollars of litigation are at stake, have been at stake. Their adverse impacts on an industry, the state explicitly is calling upon to make us more energy independent. We can talk about that a little bit more, but the Next Gen Board actually has submitted a report to the legislature with a clear roadmap to a future that calls upon the use of more biofuels to displace petroleum. So while we may want to compartmentalize and make some of these complicated, confusing, costly issues simple, they're not. If we look at the bigger picture of who we are as a state and what you have done as a legislature and what you will be called upon to do, that is to make us more energy independent with biofuels, do we really want to have a tax policy that is somehow at odds with or does the exact opposite of what we want as a renewable energy policy? So at this point, what I'd like to do is turn the overview over to Don Gales. And while some of you may have been in an ethanol plant and physically have seen and observed what we're talking about, we want to make sure we're all on the same page and that we have an understanding about the distinction between process tanks and storage tanks and other related facilities that involve a roof, ceiling, walls, and floor.
Thank you, Mr. Rudnick. Mr. Gales and Senator Coonan, I think we'll try to wrap this up a little bit before 10, and I'd like to leave some time for the department also, so if you kind of keep that in mind as you're scheduling your testifiers. Mr. Gales.
My name's Don Gales. I'm CEO of Guardian Energy in Janesville, Minnesota. I'd like to start by going through the process description that was handed out. This facility that we're going to review in this process description is Alcorn Clean Fuels in Claremont, Minnesota. This is one of the first farmer-owned ethanol plants in Minnesota. It was built in 1995, long after the past legislation was written. If you go inside the first page, this just gives a broad diagram of the dry mill ethanol process, and that's what most of the industry is. And there's a lot of similarities to making ethanol, to making beer, and doing other things. I'm not going to go through the first diagram because we'll walk through it. If we go to the next page that has large liquefaction tanks, when you're making anything that's fermentable is you use enzymes and you use yeast. The liquefaction tanks that are in this picture require a residency of only about 120 minutes. And what we do is we grind the corn and we put enzymes with it, and the enzymes start breaking down the starch. So we got to agitate this. We got to keep it temperature controlled, and it's there for about 120 minutes for the enzymes to start working. If you want to flip to the next page, knowing that the ethanol industry is a biological process, as the liquefaction happens inside it, what we're doing is we're starting to convert those starches to sugars. We're starting to break them down and utilize them. So as we do that, they're going to take the now we're going to take the product outside the liquefaction tanks, and now we're going to move it to a fermentation tank, which is this page. The fermentation tanks at Alcorn, all about 500,000 gallons. There's six of them at this facility, and basically we're going to pump the product in there at about 700 gallons a minute. And what we do there is we add some more enzymes and we add yeast, and that's where the yeast start going to work. At this facility, there are six fermentation tanks and one beer well. You would want to flip to the next page. Each of the fermentation tanks hold 500,000 gallons. So what happens in there? Right now, the product's going to remain in there for about 60 hours. If any of you have ever seen the ethanol industry in Brazil or South America, there isn't tops on the tanks because they're not worried about environmental controls. What we have to do within inside the fermentation process is we want to keep that product at about between 90 and 92 degrees, but it's also giving off CO2 and volatile organic compounds. We trap all those with the ceiling, and we collect those, and we purify them. So the fermentation tanks convert the starch to sugar. The sugar gets converted to alcohol. So now inside this tanks, we are converting to alcohol. Moving over to the next page, is that we have to maintain a very specific temperature. If the fermenters get too hot, so if we lose electricity in the summertime, the yeast gets hot, the yeast dies, we don't create alcohol. So maintaining the temperatures between 92 and 94 degrees is extremely important. This shows the heat exchangers. We're taking product outside the fermenters, running it through the heat exchangers, putting it back in the tank, and we're keeping that product at a very specific temperature to make sure that the process works. So we're agitating it, we're adding enzymes, we're adding yeast, and we're converting the corn to starch, to sugar, to alcohol is what's going on in these tanks during these processes. You want to flip to the next page if there's any technical folks. This just gives an idea over 60 hours how much changes when you start with a kernel of corn and you're converting it to alcohol, because if we're really doing everything at a reasonably fast pace, in the course of less than 80 hours, the truck has dropped the corn at the front end of the plant, and it's going out on a truck on the other side of the plant. That's how long it takes to run it through the process, just utilizing the process takes. We want to go then to the one that has beer well slide on it, as they're not numbered. After spending the 60 hours in fermentation, we transfer that product to a beer well. Why do we transfer it? Why don't we take it directly to distillation? Well, it's a biological process, so every process vessel after every batch has got to be cleaned. So we disinfect it, and we get all the bacteria out of it, and we make sure it's clean so when we bring the next batch in, that the enzymes and the yeast can work. Product will remain in the beer well from 6 to 12 hours, and then it goes to distillation. Distillation, what we do is we separate the water and the remaining granules, which goes to distiller's grains, from the alcohol. So what we do is there's multiple distillation columns. The first one separates the solids from the liquids. The second one separates the water from the alcohol, and the third one polishes it up. Flipping over to the one that says dried distiller's grains is if we're processing a bushel of corn in the state of Minnesota, you'll get an average of about 2.85 gallons of alcohol, and you get about 15 pounds of distiller's. It gets dried. It goes to the distiller's storage. The next couple just shows the distiller's being stored. The last two pictures are of tanks, and they're the denaturant tanks and the day tanks. There is no process done in these tanks. We do believe these tanks are real property. What our discussion is if I was a business that was making plastic widgets, it's pretty simple. I got a plastic molding machine, and I have conveyor belts inside a building. That's their process equipment. For any biological, renewable energy industry, we need vessels to have our process done in. And those process vessels are what happens during the biological process, whether it's making ethanol, whether it's making LG biodiesel, they're all the same. They all require those things. Our facility, since starting in 2009, has gone through various classification changes. Our process tanks, by being added to, they originally weren't, but by being added to, the allocation added $13 million. Of real property value onto our facility, at one facility within the state. So, complicated. We have a tax law that was written before our industry even existed and wasn't even planning on. Confusing. You now have some counties that are saying distillation columns are real property. So there is confusion within the county assessors on what is and what isn't real property in an ethanol plant. Because we're moving from a large process tank to a distillation column, to an evaporator, to a molecular sieve, that there should be no question on. So there is a lot of confusion of what is real property in an ethanol plant. Last point, when we say it's costly, do we want the next generation of biofuels? Because the next generation of biofuels, whether it's LG or enzymatic, will require more tanks. Next round of technology, taking fiber out of distillers and making alcohol out of it. I ask everyone, do we want more gallons per acre now than we had this year? Do we want to be better, faster, cheaper? Do we want to bring more? That's going to require a lot of tanks that are process tanks, because it's time, temperature, moisture is what we need to create renewable energy in a cost-effective manner. That ends my comments.
Thank you. So as I look through your slides here, and you've got the picture of the slide of the DDG storage area,
yes.
So is that...
That's real property.
That's real
no
property.
No question.
And then the large ethanol storage tank, a million...
Real
gallons,
property.
Real property. And then the ones that are in the process line that you have to have in order for the ethanol to be manufactured, that's the...
Those are the tanks we're considering, and you know, it is. Every one of those tanks are very much process tanks, Senator. It's the liquefaction tanks. It's the fermenter. It's the beer well. We do believe that now that some assessors are saying distillation columns and evaporators are real property, this is strictly just around the process things. We have a lot of tanks that just store water, that just store syrup. We're not saying that those are process tanks because there is no process that goes on in those tanks. We're strictly saying if there's a process that goes on in this vessel, and it's to create, I mean, like I said, if I was creating the plastic widget, mine would be a plastic mold and a conveyor belt. In our industry, it's the tank and the equipment in it.
Thank you. Questions, members? Mr. Rudnick?
briefly?
Mr. Chair, Senators, if I could just add one more piece to the puzzle to help clarify. With respect to this notion of things being complicated, confusing, and costly, I just want to point out one other thing and maybe underscore what Mr. Gales has said, and that is we're dealing with a crabbed interpretation of a court case that is based on a statutory change that is 28 years old. That statutory change, I submit to you, did not contemplate process production tanks in a biofuel facility. Furthermore, the crabbed interpretation that you may hear from some about this notion that if a tank has a roof or ceiling, walls, and a floor, misses the point regarding process. And to show you how complicated this is and confusing, the Minnesota Department of Revenue on its website offers a guidance document called Capital Equipment. And when you review this, it goes on to explain that you must pay sales tax, but you also can qualify for a refund. And by virtue of qualifying for a refund, the Minnesota Department of Revenue is telling anybody that you really do have personal property. And I can tell you, not about all of the
facilities. Mr. Rudnick, we'll get the department up and they can talk about their documents.
Well, the point that I want to leave with you is by virtue of this document, some process facilities are being told they do have personal property, and yet there's this challenge that we're talking about real property. And finally, what we have here could be considered tax creep because if you look at the survey from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we find the following include tanks that are going to be taxable, and we even see Shell's Brewery on the list here, and we see wineries on the list. So where does it end? So complicated, confusing, and costly because a lot of litigation is involved. So just to tie it all together, what's the solution? We're talking about a subset of the universe of tanks. And the proposed bill language before you is simply a narrow subset of the universe of tanks. It goes to a biofuel industry that is vibrant in Minnesota, supporting about 12,000 jobs alone and pumping $5 billion into the Minnesota economy. And this bill language actually would bring the 1985 provision back into the 21st century, where 21st century biofuels are displacing petroleum, creating jobs, and pumping money into the economy. So this committee and the Minnesota legislature has a great opportunity to fix a problem and bring us all up to speed to the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Coonan, I think we'll ask Mr. Innes, did you have something to add?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Coonan.
I think we should just go through the testifiers list now.
Yeah.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ward.
Welcome, Mr. Innes.
Yep, thank you, Chairman. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes. I'm here on behalf of Summit and Shell's Brewing Companies. And first and foremost, I want to commend the senator for coming forward with a bill to clarify an area of law that within the last few years has become somewhat murky due to that 2007 Supreme Court case. Having said that, I am not aware of any brewery fermentation tanks that are currently treated as real property. The local assessors and the Department of Revenue have consistently and appropriately classified those tanks as personal property, and they've not been subject to property tax. And it's worth noting, I think, that these tanks at the brewery fermentation tanks are enclosed inside a facility. They are they serve no structural function to the building that they're housed in. As the previous testifier said, they're also eligible for the capital equipment sales tax refund when they are purchased. So I think they've been consistently treated as personal property. I do look at the Supreme Court case, and I still think that the fermentation tanks that the breweries purchase are, in fact, personal property under current law. But you also had to read that Supreme Court case, and the court seemed to be pleading for some clarification from the legislature. It's clearly an old law that hasn't been interpreted in recent years by the Supreme Court, and they were struggling. It was clearly they were struggling about where to draw the lines between personal and real property. And so I think when there's that kind of doubt on the court, I think there's some value to bringing some clarity via the legislature.
Well, thank you, Mr. Innes, and that's why we have this in front of the committee early in session. We will have a chance to, you know, get all the people in a room and sit down and see if we can hammer something out that will work for everybody.
Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Chair Skoy. I would just add, I appreciate, Mr. Innes, your testimony to that effect. And, you know a little bit more about taxes than the average person. But I would just say for the committee's benefit that the alarm has been raised, especially amongst the craft brewing industry. Duluth has become kind of a craft brewing destination, and I've heard from my brewers at home. So I appreciate, Senator Coonan, you bringing this forward, because I think while that has been the history, some written clarification would be helpful.
Mr. Innes.
And Chairman, Senator Reinhart, your point is very well taken. You know, some of the emails that I have read that went out to the craft breweries, I think, had some misinformation in them. Actually, they indicated that the Department of Revenue had sent out guidance, you know, requesting that all these breweries be taxed as real property. And I had discussions with the Department of Revenue, and they have not issued any guidance to that effect. So I think that's one reason why I thought it was good for me to get on the record. We're continuing discussions with the Department of Revenue to get a little more clarity around this. Ultimately, it may be within the purview of you folks to actually take that next step and provide that clarity. But, yeah, thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Innes. Let's bring up the two assessors and the Association of Minnesota Counties, Mr. Whitman, Mr. Jacobson, and Mr. Berenson. Who would like to go first?
I'm first on the list, so good morning.
Mr. Whitman, Chair, introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Sir. Well, my name is Dan Whitman. I am the county assessor in Martin County, Minnesota, and I'm here today to represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, MAAO. We do come with a great deal of concern with...
Sir, could you pull the mic into yourself a little bit? It's hard to hear in this room.
Not very often do they say I'm not loud enough, so thank you. We do come with concern about this piece of legislation. I guess it's the assessor's organization's position that we do feel that there is clarity in the statute. The statute is, we feel, quite clear about the definition of real property. And the decision in 2007 by the Supreme Court, which was an affirmation of the tax court's decision that these sorts of vessels are taxable, gave us further clarity, and they went on to define three steps that should be used to define this even more clearly. And with those three steps, we do feel that there is a clarity within the law at that point. Assessors organization and assessors throughout the state, you know, have tried to apply those rules and the rule of law, and so we do feel that we have been getting more and more equitable throughout the last several years, to the point where we feel there is a great deal of equity within the state at this time, applying the rule of law and using the guidance of the Supreme Court, the District Court, and the Tax Court. The great concern we have is that if a law such as this were to be passed, that it would create a great deal of inequity throughout the state once again, because now we're going to have a defined group of tanks that are exempt, opposed to the rest of the industry where they would be taxable. And I think I heard Senator Coonan say that he's not intending to change the Renville County Supreme Court's decision. And so, as I thought I heard him say, that would leave the sugar beet plant tanks as taxable, but the ethanol tanks would be exempt, and that's the kind of inequity that we're really worried about. We're going to have some tanks that are taxable and some are not, and we're pulling out a certain part of the overall industry using tanks, and now we don't have an equity again. So,
Mr. Whitman, it seems to me that we currently have tanks that are in beer brewers that are not taxed, and the proposal from the department that I'm understanding is to tax the very comparable tank that's in an ethanol plant doing a very similar function that is part of the process of producing ethanol. It's not just a storage tank. If you actually remove the tank from the line, the process doesn't work.
So where are we with that part of the discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I can't speak for the department, of course, but I don't know of any, I have not heard of that kind of direction. And the rule of law, you know, written in the first part of the statute 272.03, it defines real property as property, a structure that is annexed to the land or annexed to the structure. And that's the definition of real property. And, you know, that's found in, you know, subdivision one, and then there are some exclusions, but sub three goes on to define the exclusion even farther and say that does not the exclusion does not apply to the exterior shell. You know, we're total agreement that all of the equipment within these tanks is exempt because that's it's the stirrers and all of those things are absolutely not taxable. They are exempt, and all we deal with is that structure, that shell, that is defined within this statute, saying that the, you know, the shell and the ceiling and the floor are the taxable structure that's providing structure for that property. So, you know, in my case, my fermenters and beer well are 1 million gallons each. I can't really compare that to a microbrewery where they've got a couple hundred gallons or whatever they are. I don't have that in my county, so I can't address that from a personal standpoint. But when something becomes affixed to the ground or to the building itself so that it's a permanent part of that building or that property, and you know, you couldn't remove that without significantly changing that building or property, that's when it, to me, it becomes, I think the law says that becomes real property at that point.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson.
Glenn Jacobson, Assistant Renville County Attorney. I initially planned to be here for informational purposes. I was local counsel for 8 years on the Southern Minnesota sugar beet plants. If anybody has any questions relating to those, I'm as good as anybody on that. In addition to the Supreme Court case mentioned, there was also the later Court of Appeals case that further defined some of these things. I was glad to hear the comments here and to clarify that the current real property designation is only to the exterior shell, the floor, walls, ceilings, if there are any. All of those factors are not required. Those are elements that are looked at in determining what is real property, and to clarify that the internal process equipment is currently not taxable. It is recognized as personal property. The initial concerns that I had with Senator Coonan's proposed legislation is that instead of using descriptors, he's using names. A fermentation and beer well. To best of my knowledge, there's no such thing as a fermentation and beer well. As was discussed earlier, there are fermentation tanks, there are beer wells, there are other things like that. But if we're talking about trying to get clarity in the law and reducing litigation, I will guarantee you that there will be experts that will say that this is a fermentation tank and this is not a fermentation tank. If we're making something taxable or tax exempt based on its name, we are looking at a world of hurt. We need to use it by descriptors so that when something isn't this name or that name, the assessors in the various counties can make a determination, is it taxable real estate or is it process equipment? And that needs to be used by its function, by its attributes, not by what someone has chosen to call it. I was especially concerned with one of the comments by Senator Coonan in that he doesn't know how far this would go. And that is exactly our concern. Once you start go along with the comments here. Once you start by saying tanks are exempt or fermentation tanks are exempt, then what about these tanks? What about the next tanks? What about the next tanks? Once we change this or amend this legislation to say tanks are exempt, we are now talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of property tax shifting to the residents of the state, because those tanks are all over the place. And they are very large and they are very expensive, in the order of millions of dollars apiece for some of them. And if you're going to exempt them, then that very quickly gets shifted back to the population of this state. (Clears throat) The pole barn is not what the Supreme Court was looking at in the Southern Men case. The arguments that went on for days, for weeks, were exactly this argument. Is this process equipment or is this real estate? In the initial tax court case, in the Supreme Court case, in the later district court case, and in the Court of Appeals case, those were the issues that were argued. Is this process equipment or is this real estate? And those decisions give very clear guidance as to what is process, and that is the equipment, and what is real estate, and that is the exterior shells, floors, roof, ceilings, walls, things like that, that provide a sheltering function.
Thank you. Questions, members? Mr. Berenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bo Berenson. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. When this bill was introduced, we circulated the language among our membership to get some response from our local counties. And what we heard from many counties, especially those that are currently assessing and taxing these tanks, is concerns about the resulting tax shift that would happen if this bill were passed. As you know, exempting certain property from taxes does not eliminate its share of the property tax levy. Rather, it simply shifts that burden to other property owners. In Fillmore County, for example, their assessor estimates that if this bill were to pass, roughly $50,000 worth of local property taxes would be shifted away from these properties and onto other property owners in the county. This is obviously a concern to local government officials who have to help explain to taxpayers why their property tax bills may increase independent of any changes to valuation or local levies. I think these concerns are borne out by the revenue estimate I believe everyone has from the Department of Revenue that shows that the state would have to make significant investments in the property tax refund program as a result of the anticipated increases to homestead property taxes that could occur because of this bill.
Thank you. Anything? Mr. Jacobson, would you be willing to forward to my office some of the information on this court definition of process?
Certainly.
I'd like to read that if I could, please. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair, could I just briefly,
Mr. Whitman,
switch hats clearly from the assessor's organization over to
very
Martin
briefly,
County.
Please.
Very briefly, what he was just talking about is what I've coming from our county, Martin County. There's a real concern about that shift in the small village of Welcome. They annexed land in order to accommodate this ethanol plant there, and right now they have $6.458 million of value on those tanks. Only. That's between 12% and 13% of the total value of the whole city. And so if they were exempted, that's going to be a 12.5% to 13% shift to the houses and in that city alone. It's very significant. And with them, you know, giving them concessions to get the plant now to change that would be, they've expressed a lot of concern.
That plant is not in a Job Z zone?
It is in a Job Z, yes.
Well, currently, then, it's not impacting because it's exempt from it.
That's correct.
That's part of the reason that we wanted to deal with this earlier rather than later is because many of these plants are in Job Zs, and so that
they are.
It's less of an impact. But we'll look at that as we go through. Any questions, members? Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Coonan and perhaps somebody from the department. I don't know, Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Hagan. I'm director of the Property Tax Division with the Department of Revenue. And first
Welcome
of all, I'm certainly not an expert on ethanol tanks or fermentation tanks or things like that. But there has certainly, and I would really applaud the committee for laying this over for further discussion because based on some of the conversations, I think that's a very wise way to proceed. The department does not have a position for or against this bill. Our job is to administer the law. We feel that taxing or exempting tanks would be a policy decision, which is beyond our scope. That's the scope of the legislature. In this case, we do have legislation which has been discussed at length. We believe does allow for the taxation of ethanol fermentation tanks and beer wells. And in this case, we also have the Supreme Court decision that's been talked about, the Renville Supreme Court decision, and the tax court decision that was upheld by the Supreme Court, affirming that these tanks were, in fact, taxable as real property. A couple of mischaracterizations I'd like to clear up. For people like myself who really don't know what we're talking about when we talk about a fermentation tank, this is a picture of a fermentation tank, which looks very, very similar to some of the huge grain bins and tanks that are currently being assessed without any discussion. There are a few things were mischaracterized, and I'm certainly wasn't intentional, but there's some confusion out there. The survey that was talked about, the Department of Revenue sent out, was that by no means identifying property that was to be taxed. It was trying to get a lay of the land, just try to identify the landscape, what kind of tanks were out there, what kind of properties were out there, without making any determination about the tax status of those properties. Additionally, as Mr. Innes testified, we have never sent out any direction or information or request to assessors that beer wineries or breweries should have their tanks taxed or valued. What we do, again, is we base our interpretation on the law and on the tank, on the decision of the Supreme Court affirming the tax court decision. So our interpretation of what is taxable does not really, it extends from the sugar beet industries into the ethanol industries, and I don't believe we've ever issued any direction beyond that of what should be taxable.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Do you want to add something?
No, sir.
Oh, okay. Any questions, members? So, Mr. Hagan, we're going to have further discussions on this, but just so I can be clear in my mind about what I need to be contemplating. So the sugar beet plant, I think there the tanks really truly were just a storage tank. They could have been removed from the line, and it wouldn't have impacted the operations of the sugar beet plant at all. Now, in my mind, that's how you start to review whether it's part of the process or not. And I don't know if the court looks at it that way or not, and that's why I asked for some of the information from that gentleman. Do you have any information that you could add to that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't. That's something that will hopefully be understood through our discussions, but perhaps Mr. Tom Reinecke does.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Reinecke. I'm an appraiser for the Department of Revenue and a property tax compliance officer for a number of northeastern Minnesota counties and southeastern counties in Minnesota. And with regard to the sugar beet case, there's a bin at the facility called a Weibel bin, and it's my understanding that this structure is approximately a 7-story bin that processes sugar. And what happens is hot, wet sugar is pumped into the top of this facility, and it's sprinkled out by a moving arm at the top, much like a lawn sprinkler. And it dries as it falls, and it accumulates in the bottom of this bin. And after 3 days, I believe it's shoveled out as dry sugar because nobody wants to buy hot, wet sugar. There's an elevator in the building, a lot of moving parts, and the moving parts and elevator were classified as personal property, but the exterior shell, roof, and the walls of this facility were deemed to be real property. And that's where we're coming from when we look at this fermentation tank at the Preston facility down in Fillmore County. It has an exterior shell, it has a roof, it has walls, it has a floor. It satisfies the statute. So if we're going to do something different, I think we need to revisit the definition of real property in statute, sir.
Okay, thank you. Anything else, members? Anything else, Senator Coonan?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you can see, this needs some work yet. It's not, this definitely isn't black and white, but thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you all, and we'll continue this discussion. We'll lay Senate File 394 over for further effort and possible inclusion. We are going to move to Senate File 119. And Senator Rest got called away to a chair. And Senator Coonan?
Okay, Senator Scoy, is this going to be laid over? This bill going to be laid over also?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. We are discussing Senate File 119. The House has sent to the Senate House File Number 6, which is the federal conformity bill. So we are planning on having the discussion about the federal tax conformity provisions that are in Senate File 119. This is a division report. In the division, an amendment was added that makes changes to, or actually included, a number of the provisions from last year's vetoed tax bill. So we're going to do a brief discussion of that, those provisions also. I think most of us are pretty familiar with it. Many of the members here serve on the division. But I think to start with here, we should start with a little bit of an overview of what the conformity provisions are. The conformity provisions are an effort to deal with the tax changes that occurred at the end of last year as the federal government made permanent tax changes in their fiscal cliff discussions. They include things like extending the higher education tuition deduction, extending the educator classroom expense deduction, extending authority for individuals age 70 and a half or older to transfer up to $100,000 from an IRA or Roth IRA directly to a qualifying charity. There is AMT fix in there where they are having an inflation adjustment on alternative minimum tax. There is a provision for a mortgage insurance deduction. And then an amendment was added on the House floor, is included in our bill, dealing with employees of Northwest Airline when Delta purchased that company. There was a timing issue with their IRAs so that they didn't have double taxation there. So that is included in there, along with a number of other provisions. And was Ms. McQuaid going to walk through the spreadsheet on this? There is a fiscal cost to this, members, of about $18.5 million. That is money that is currently in our general funder. And if it was not to be used for this activity, would go to pay the school shift back. So if Ms. McQuaid could walk through that spreadsheet, please.
Ms. McQuaid.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll walk through the spreadsheet titled Senate File 119, the committee engrossment. It should be in your packets. It says Senate File 119, committee engrossment. As Senator Scoy mentioned, the total for this bill is $18.5 million in the current biennium, and then a reduction of $70 million in the next biennium, and $2.25 million in the fiscal year 16 and 17 biennium. So I'll just walk through each of the provisions that was extended temporarily and for tax year 12. And in general, some of these provisions have costs in later years because of the way expensing can be done. So some costs are reflected in later years, but most of the cost is in the first year.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Scoy.
And Ms. McQuaid, would be clear that we are only dealing with the 2012 costs in this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, the bill that was signed by the federal government made some temporary extensions for tax year 12 and 13, and they also made some permanent provisions. This bill only addresses those provisions for tax year 12. So beginning on line 21 of the spreadsheet, there's a deduction for educator expenses up to $250. This was extended for tax year 12. On line 25, there's an extension of an allowance to exclude fringe benefits from employer-provided mass transit from income. That's a negligible cost to the state. Premiums for mortgage insurance are deductible just as interest is, mortgage interest is deductible. That extension is a cost of $3.9 million in this fiscal year 13. As Senator Skoy mentioned, the deduction for qualified tuition and related expenses was extended for tax year 12 at a cost of $5.3 million for the state. There's an allowance for filers over the age of 70 and a half to make a tax-free donation to certain charities, and that cost is $1.7 million in fiscal year 13. I'm sorry, I skipped over line 29. There's a special rule that allows filers to deduct the value of property donated for conservation, and that's a cost of $300,000. And then back down to line 35, there is a provision to extend the date by which qualified improvements for qualified leaseholds and restaurant and retail improvements must be placed into service. That has an individual income tax cost and a corporate franchise tax cost of $150,000 and $250,000 in fiscal year 13. On line 38, there's a 7-year recovery period for certain motorsports racing track facilities. This allows more generous rules for depreciation of motorsports racing facilities. Then there's an allowance for accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations for tax year 12 and 13. Again, this bill just addresses tax year 12. This modifies the depreciation rules for business property on Indian reservations. On line 43, there's an extension for allowing charitable contributions to non-C corporations, and that's a cost of $600,000 each, or in the fiscal year 13. There's a cost associated with increasing the Section 179 expensing, and what Minnesota does is add back 80% and then allows that to be subtracted over a 5-year period. The cost here is attributable to raising the deduction limit that the feds had extended for tax year 12. The election to expense mine safety equipment is an allowance of a taxpayer to deduct 50% of the mine safety equipment. Special expensing rules for certain film and television productions. This allows productions to deduct the cost in the year in which they were incurred instead of depreciating that expense over time. On line 53, this provides special rules if payments to controlling exempt organizations reduce the net unrelated business income. Then on the next page, it continues the treatment for certain dividends of regulated investment companies allows certain dividends to not be subject to a tax when received by a non-resident alien or foreign corporation. On line 57, there's an exemption for subpart F for active financing income in tax year 12 and 13. Again, this bill is just for the conformity for tax year 12. It extends the allowance of U.S. shareholders with a 10% or greater interest in controlled foreign corporations to defer the recognition of that income that's not yet dispersed to its shareholders. That's at a cost of $1.5 million for fiscal year 13. There's an allowance to increase from 50% to 100% the exclusion of gain on certain small business stock. That revenue, that conformity for tax year 12 does not, the revenue loss there does not show up until fiscal year 17. So it's still tracked on here, but there is no cost until the biennial, which we do not track. The basis adjustment to S corporations stock for charitable contributions of property extends the limit on basis adjustments in S corporation stock to tax basis rather than to the fair market value of the property. That's at a cost of $300,000 in fiscal year 13. There's a reduction, a conformity item for the reduction in the recognition period for S corporation built-in gains tax. This is $600,000 in fiscal year 13. It extends the reduction in the minimum holding period to avoid the tax on built-in gains on the sale of assets when an S corporation converts to a C corporation. Those provisions that were temporarily extended total $17.1 million in fiscal year 13. And those were the provisions of the Taxpayer Relief Act. There is an additional, as Senator Skoy mentioned, conformity issue with the FAA Modernization Act to deal with the payments made after a bankruptcy of airlines, and that is a cost of $1.4 million in fiscal year 13. In addition, the bill also added a change allowing Marshall County flood payments, and that is a negligible cost in the biennium, not in fiscal year 13, but in the next biennium. That completes the spreadsheet walkthrough.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. McQuaid. So, members, these are the conformity provisions. This is a timing issue. Minnesotans are filling out their tax forms now. We need to act on this sooner rather than later. I understand that. I also have been working hard to try to include the provisions from last year's vetoed bill in this bill. And to that effort, we amended this in division. And I'm going to ask Ms. Pollack and Mr. Silva to walk through some of those provisions. There are two provisions that were
Madam
in the
Chair, forgive me, Senator Skoy, but Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
If I could, I'd like to just ask a question about the conformity provisions and the spreadsheet that Ms. McQuaid just went through.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I read the bill, I did not see a designated source for the funds, the $18.5 million. It's on the spreadsheet on line item number one, and I just wanted to confirm. I know that there's usually a default. So if Ms. McQuaid could, I would appreciate if she could explain the source of funds that we're using to pay for the bill.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Ortman. I think I did address that in my opening comments, that this will be coming out of the dollars that would have gone to pay back the school shift if this tax conformity bill were not to move forward. But Ms. McQuaid.
Madam Chair and members, if the bill is passed before the February forecast is completed and reported and issued, then if there's any revenue on the bottom line, this will take away from that revenue. If there is a deficit, then it will add $18.5 million to that deficit.
Senator Ortman, further question.
Madam Chair and Ms. McQuaid, is there any tie between the funding here and the increased revenues, like the $114 million that we just learned were over and above forecast? Is there any tie to that funding or any relationship?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, given the recent revenues for the months between the November and the February forecast, that does suggest that there is some increased revenues coming in, and this would take then $18.5 million out of that money on the bottom line.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you. And members, I'm going to have, as I mentioned, Ms. Pollack and Mr. Silva walk through the provisions that are in the bill. There are two provisions that I wanted to talk about just briefly that I did not include. It's not that I'm not supportive of them, but I think we're going to have a lot of ongoing discussion this year about sales taxes. And so I did not include the sales tax to nonprofits provision, and I did not include Senator Ingebrigtsen's sales tax exemption for nursing homes. I don't want that to be construed as not being supportive of it, but I think that it would be better fit if we include those at a later time when we're doing our sales tax provisions in the larger bill.
And Senator Skoy, I think we were also trying to avoid any general fund impact on the local provisions that we were putting in, too. Even if they were negligible, we were trying to avoid that.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Silvey and I will just briefly summarize the provisions that are contained in the summary in your packets for the committee engrossment of Senate File 119. Section 1 refers to promotion of the Angel Credit in Greater Minnesota. This was a provision last year from Senator Nelson and Senator Rosen, I believe, requiring the Commissioner of Deed to promote the Angel Investment Credit in Greater Minnesota. It allows for an increased percentage of the total credits available to Greater Minnesota businesses if the promotion of the goal is not reached. Sections 2, 3, 8, and 31 all deal with the Internal Revenue Code federal conformity, which Senator Skoy and Ms. McQuay outlined, so I won't go into any further detail about those. Sections 4 to 6 make some clarifying changes for the application process and the assignments of credits or transfers for the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit. These were provisions from Senator Ortman's and Senator Senjum's bills last year. Section 7 makes some changes, clarifying changes regarding how transfers are organized and tracked. And I think Mr. Sylvia has the next few sections.
Madam Chair and members, sections
Mr.
9.
Mr. Sylvia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sections 9 through 14 and 17 and 18 all deal with a newly created tax increment financing district. And because of a new district, there are other corresponding areas of the tax increment financing law that had to be changed to accommodate this. So those sections all deal with the change, adding duration limits and corresponding authorization for that district. Section 15 and 16 extend the so-called jobs bill.
Madam Chair. Senator Skoy.
Could I interrupt, Mr. Silva?
Certainly.
That provision that Mr. Silva is talking about, that is the general law provision that was included in last year's bill dealing with the reclamation of gravel pits or mines. And we think
both in Apple Valley and Maple Grove.
Apple Valley and Maplewood, and we think Senator Ortman's work was very good there.
Mr. Sylvia, may you have more?
Madam Chair, Section 20 extends the special law authorizing the St. Paul's Capital Improvement Bonding Program. Currently, it was set to expire in 2013, and this would extend that authorization until 2024. Section 21 expands the authorized use of the levy for the Cook or ambulance services to include attached machinery, portable equipment, and also would specifically exclude operation expenses from the levy authorization.
Madam Ms. Chair. Section 22 expands the criteria for cities eligible for grant funds from the Rochester local income sales tax. With these criteria, the only city that would qualify is Wanamingo. And then skipping over to sections 25 and 26, this allows an expansion of the uses of the St. Cloud and area cities local sales tax and extends the tax to 2038 if that extension is approved by the voters at a general election by November 2017.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 24 deals with the Itasca County Nursing Home, and what this allows is that in addition to revenue bonds, that general obligation bonds would also be allowed to finance nursing home improvements and renovations subject to a reverse referendum. Section 27 is a bill that concerns an Oakdale Tax Increment Financing District, and what this would do is allow certain parcels to be included as being deemed occupied by substandard buildings for purposes of redevelopment tax increment financing district. Section 28 allows farmers in Marshall County to retain their agricultural homestead credit. These farmers were forced to move away from their farm due to flooding in 2009, and this would allow them to retain that agricultural homestead classification. Section 29 is a Dakota County redevelopment tax increment financing district, and this would allow the Dakota County Community Development Agency to create a tax increment financing district subject to specified special rules. And Section 30 would allow a tax increment financing district number 2 located in the city of St. Cloud to be treated as a gap district for purposes of spending funds. That's Section 30.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. And Ms. Pollack, Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, I believe there is an amendment that needs to be offered to this bill.
The
I'm going to need a copy of
Senator
the amendment
Skoy
also.
Moves to amend the committee engrossment of Senate file number 119 as follows, the A-17 amendment. Senator Skoy, you want to explain what's happening here.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, much of this amendment is technical. There are a couple of issues in here that we needed to deal with. First of all, Section 2 is an area that was brought to me by Commissioner Franz. The department is concerned about the accuracy of the Minnesota tax incident study with the inclusion of federal taxes paid by Minnesota residents in that. Thought is that the Minnesota tax incident study is an assessment of taxes that Minnesota pay that is controlled and impacted by Minnesota state and local governments. And we think that this change will bring more value to the tax incident study. And Commissioner Franz has requested that we move forward on this because this is a timeliness issue, that this is done sooner rather than later. There is a small change in here dealing with the Rochester provision where we're including, looks like, five other cities in that zone, and I've talked to Senator Senjum about that, and he doesn't see a problem with it.
Senator, is that the provision that deals right now just with Wanamingo?
Just with Wanamingo.
I thought, Senator Skoy, I thought Senator Schmidt had mentioned another community that's not here.
Senator Schmidt had talked to me about Mazeppa, and that is included
in here.
It was
Mazeppa. Okay. Thank you. Questions or comments about the amendment?
Madam Chair, just maybe before. Okay, I'm sorry.
Did you want to comment on that provision?
Just briefly, and this is for the benefit of other maybe newer tax members. This is somewhat unique in the Rochester sales tax bill last year that was passed. There was a decision made to share back, if you will, to communities surrounding Rochester that have people coming to town each day that do shop in the town a lot. So I think it's somewhat unique, this whole program, but I think it also has been shown to be genuinely fair, and it created a lot more support in Rochester for the extension of the sales tax.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Any other questions or comments? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we vote on the A-17 amendment, I would like to make an amendment to it to delete lines 1.5 through 1.15, which would be the changes to the tax incident report. I don't think we need to do that. I think that's a unnecessary, in-your-face, at-the-last-minute preference by Governor Dayton to hide the facts from Minnesotans about what the federal tax burden impact has on the income taxes they pay in the state of Minnesota. And it shouldn't be a change like this shouldn't be tied to the conformity bill. Governor Dayton signed the bill that had this addition to the tax incident study in 2011. And it's funny, the timing on this, isn't it? Because today's February 14th, happy Valentine's Day, and the report is due March 1st. So did the dog eat the commissioner's homework or what? This information has already been gathered. They know what it is in the Department of Revenue. Clearly, they don't want to share with Minnesotans very important, relevant information about their tax burden. And so if you vote against my amendment to take this out, you are voting for willful ignorance. Information that we have that the state of Minnesota is refusing to share with the taxpayers and to follow current law. So shame on you for putting this in the amendment, Senator Skoy. I hope everyone will vote to take this out.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, do you disagree?
Your behavior is reprehensible.
I disagree.
It will not be tolerated.
Perfectly respectful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, I believe that the tax incident study does reference the federal income taxes paid. It's just not as visible a part of component, but I think it would be appropriate if the department would come forward and discuss this part of the bill, part of the amendment.
Ms. Bonmash, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, members. My name is Susan Bonmash from the Department of Revenue. The tax incidents report is a report that we have been doing for, I think, about 20 years at the Department of Revenue, and it's a report that analyzes state and local taxes. And the purpose of the report is to really provide information to policymakers. It actually is a projection of past taxes and where it projects out the incidence of future taxes by income decile in terms of what the incidence is of decisions that have been made in the past. So the purpose of the report is really to provide policymakers who are Minnesota policymakers who are making decisions about state and local taxes in terms of looking at information on the effect of those decisions. There is a feeling within the department that to include federal taxes where we really don't have much control over what is happening really kind of muddies the message, and it really is an addition that will not necessarily be of assistance to the state policymakers that are making decisions on Minnesota state and local taxes. And for that reason, we are supporting this amendment.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. The question that I have on that is, and I realize that this goes a little bit over into the political and not just the policy of it, but one of the things that the governor, among other elected officials in this state and candidates during election season, use to justify or rationalize or make arguments for certain kinds of tax increases and so on is the tax burden on certain groups of individuals. And so it seems to me that if that's what this incident study can be used for, then it makes no sense not to talk about the entire tax burden, because the level to which people have to pay taxes relative to one another or as an absolute number is not only somewhat dependent on but largely dependent upon the federal tax, because that's such a huge element. So it seems to me, if people are going to look at me and make the argument, well, we ought to tax these folks because they're not paying, quote, their fair share, you just about have to look at their entire tax bill, or it's an incomplete and inaccurate portrayal, I think.
Senator Skoy, you want to talk about distortions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Thompson, I think that what we're trying to do with the Minnesota Tax Incident Study is provide information to Minnesota policymakers as we make decisions about taxes that Minnesotans pay from their state and local governments. Including the federal tax information to this degree is a confusing factor because we do not control that. And perhaps Ms. Bonmash would be able to talk. You do reference this information in the report, but the asterisk or as footnote.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I apologize. I would have to go back and reference the report to remember the exact reference, but I believe there is some reference in the report as to the fact that federal taxes do have some incidence also. And again, when the Department of Revenue during the past year, when Commissioner Franz has been out traveling the state talking about tax reform, we have been using the slide from the last incidence report that came out in 2011 that shows the impact by decile, and the information we're using is the state and local tax information, which are the taxes and the decisions that are made by state and local policymakers.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Skoy and Ms. Bonmash, we talk about distortions, and I've read through the tax incident study. I like to, it's nice reading. But distortions, I mean, clearly you can take the federal piece and separate that from the Minnesota piece. I mean, and you know, the thing has been distorted quite a bit in conversations, but is that how the report would be written? The governor passed this last year. The legislature passed this 2011. And we all agreed to that, and now we want to strike it again. So the governor's going to now agree with something he disagreed with something he did 2 years ago. But as far as distortions, I mean, you break that federal piece out, right? I mean, that would show a total tax burden of all people in the state.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Von Wash,
Chamberlain, I have to tell you the truth. I have not. I know they're working on the report. I have not seen a draft of the report yet. It is usually sent to the commissioner's office when it's completed, and I have not seen a copy of the report yet to know exactly how it's going to be presented.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Von Mosch. The report's due in 2 weeks. If this doesn't become law, do you have the information?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I would have to check with the research people who are working on the project. I have actually been busy working on a few other issues lately, so I have not checked in with them to see about the status of the report.
Well, and Madam Chair, Ms. Von Mosch,
Senator Ortman,
the Minnesotans' tax burden in the tax incidence study as it is shows quite a bit of progressivity in the income tax. It would show more progressivity even if the federal tax burden were included. Isn't that true?
Madam Chair, Senator Orton, I am not sure of the answer to that question right now.
We have the
Madam Chair,
Ortman amendment
ask?
To the amendment to, in effect, delete Section 2.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Ms. Von Mosch, could you get me that information right away, please, to confirm the additional progressivity of the income tax burden of Minnesotans when you add in the federal burden?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I will check to see if that information is available.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion? We have the Ortman amendment. Amendment to the amendment. Senator Senjan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This was a thought well discussed last year. I think generally speaking, there was a feeling amongst the tax committee members and frankly amongst the legislature that this would be good information for policymakers going forward in terms of making these tax policy decisions. And so I'm saddened to see it in here and certainly support Senator Ortman's amendment and would ask for a roll call.
The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Scoy?
No.
Senator Bach?
No.
Senator Chamberlain?
Yes.
Senator Dietzick?
No.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Coonan?
No.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Reinert?
No.
Senator Rest?
No.
Senator Sinjum?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
There being 5 ayes and 8 noes, the motion does not prevail and the amendment to the amendment is not adopted. Is there further discussion on the A-17 amendment? Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, I would renew my motion to A-17.
The A-17 amendment is before us. Any further discussion? Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Senator Scoy.
Yes.
Senator Bach.
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain.
No.
Senator Dietzick?
Yes.
Senator Eaton?
Yes.
Senator Coonan?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Ortman?
No.
Senator Reinert?
Yes.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Sinjum?
No.
Senator Thompson?
No.
There being 8 in favor and 5 opposed, the amendment, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There's one other issue that has been brought to us by Commissioner Sertich
There's a timing issue that they're, because of redistricting, they were unable to organize their board. And in order for them to move forward, I think there's an amendment Senator Tomasoni has been working on somewhere in the room. Is that amendment around?
Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, I would move the A13 amendment.
The A13 amendment is being distributed. If you'd give one to the author and then to the chair and then to the rest of the committee, please.
Madam Chair.
Just one moment. Senator Bach, is this going to be your amendment or Senator Skoy's?
I guess I'm willing to move it.
Senator Bach moves the A13 amendment, which is now before us. Senator Bach, you want to explain it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the IRRRB board and all of the spending that it does relative to taconite taxes is all contained in Section 298. They're all tax issues. What this is an update of the membership of the board and the votes that it requires to expend money from all the different accounts that the taconite taxes flow into. The reason that this amendment had to come forward before we could actually constitute a board is because of redistricting. The current law says that the majority of the members on the IRRRB board, and there are currently 5 senators, 5 House members, the legislative members, the law says the majority of them have to have 50% of their constituents residing in the taconite relief area. As a result of redistricting, that's not possible any longer. So what the amendment does is changes that threshold down to 33%, and that then will make it consistent with the majority, or at least a third of your constituents residing in the taconite relief area, that the majority of the Senate members and the House members would need to fit that criteria. The other thing that it does, and this may make some people a little uncomfortable, and I did talk with Senator Thompson about it yesterday, is, and I should say, Senator Tomasoni actually has a bill on this. It's been heard in the Jobs Committee. It's sitting on general orders right now. And this amendment is different in 2 ways than what Senator Tomasoni actually passed in the additional bill. And the place where it's different is the Tomasoni bill had you had to meet the rigid 1/3 provision to be on the board. And what that created was a board of 8 people, 5 House members, 3 Senate members. There currently are 5 and 5. I felt and talked with Senator Tomasoni that having a board with an even number of members on it is problematic, especially as it relates to Iron Rangers and their reputation for kind of knocking heads with each other. It seems like from time to time we'd had a tie vote, and I don't know how we would resolve that. So what I'm proposing in this amendment that's different from Senator Tomasoni's bill is it allows the subcommittee on committees of the Senate to be able to add 1 additional Senate member to it. Wouldn't have to reside in the taconite relief area, but so the composition of the board then would be 9 legislators, 4 from the Senate, 5 from the House. I think that's a better option for us. The piece that is making some people uncomfortable is Senator Sertich and the other members of the board, I think, all concur that back during the Ventura years, when a decision was made to take the DNR commissioner off the board, the DNR commissioner was the odd number, the 11th person on the board back then, a member of the administration, the governor's appointee, you might say. Back during the Ventura years, a decision was made to take the DNR commissioner off, give the governor a different appointment of somebody that's a regular citizen, and then give the House and Senate each a citizen appointment. I don't believe that we're meeting the intent of that any longer.
Currently, the previous board for a number of years now has had a former legislator on it, appointed first by the House and most recently appointed by the governor. Currently, there is not only that former legislator that wants to remain on the board, there's another recently retired state legislator that is now asking the House to appoint them to the board. So, and it's very hard to tell former lawmakers that they're not citizens and that they don't have a right to be on there. It's also very hard for leaders of the House or Senate or the governor's office to not allow those citizens from a community who certainly have a great deal of knowledge about the workings of the board, that they don't have the experience to be a good member of the board. But I don't believe it's meeting the intent, and I was here in 2000 or 2001 when we did that. The intent clearly wasn't a place to park former lawmakers after they retire. And I just don't think there's a way, unless someone has an idea, that we can exclude them. They clearly are citizens of the state. So, and I know that makes people a little uncomfortable, but we're just not getting what I think people would think of as ordinary citizens to participate, because it's just very difficult to accomplish that. So the other change that's different from the Tomassoni bill is, in the fine tradition of the state Senate, we're catching errors that were made along the way. What the bill that passed out of the Jobs Committee deleted, when it deleted the composition of the board and put the new composition in, they overlooked the fact that they did not give the new members of the board a term. And currently those people serve from January in the odd-numbered year to the January of the next odd-numbered year. They deleted that along with some other provisions. So the default would be then for them to fall back under a general law provision for appointments, which would require a staggering. That staggering doesn't work well because somebody may not win the next election and may no longer meet the criteria of actually being a board member, but their term actually wouldn't be up yet. So I'm not, it wouldn't work well that way. So thanks to Senate counsel, that's the other difference in here from the Tomassoni bill. It actually reinstates the current term that those members have. So, and members, I'd appreciate your support. And I don't know if Senator Tomassoni is here to speak to his bill, but I think that kind of pretty adequately explains it, I think.
Before I call on Senator Skoy to comment, Senator Bach, have you discussed your amendment with Senator Tomassoni? Do you know if he's generally in support, even though he's not here?
Madam President, he does support it, or Madam Chair, he does support it.
He does. Okay. Senator Skoy, response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Bach. I understand the timeliness of this in order to get the IRRRB back up and running. I did have the opportunity to serve on that for one term. It's a very interesting and worthwhile activities that are done there, and I'm supporting his effort.
Is there any other discussion of the A13 amendment? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, and to Senator Bach, I'm wondering, why is this not just going as a standalone bill? Why are we changing the parameters and the membership on the IRRRB in the middle of the tax conformity bill?
Well,
Senator Skoy, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, there's some urgency with this to get a board constituted. The Senate has a bill sitting on the floor. I don't believe the bill has had a hearing in the House yet. I don't know what their calendar is, but there is just some urgency to get this updated.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, would your amendment take out all of the citizen members and leave only those appointed by the House and the Senate?
Senator Bach.
Madam President, it restores the board to being all legislators, which is what the situation of the board historically has been prior to the change during the Ventura years. It does take the three citizens off. It reduces the number of legislators on the board by one, from 10 down to 9.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, I was asked on behalf of folks that think that citizen membership is important to the accountability of the IRRB to offer the A18 amendment.
We'll wait until members have it. Senator Ortman moves the A18 amendment, which is an amendment to the A13 amendment, which is Senator Bach's amendment. Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, I have spoken to the amendment. I believe that citizen membership is very important to this board and to the accountability. It serves residents, not just government and not just the legislature, and I think they're a very important part.
Senator Bach. Do you have questions? Senator Ortman, is your amendment just reinstating what the current law language is, or is it something different? It's not clear to me.
Madam Chair, what this does is it would designate non-legislator appointed members, and I believe that solves the problem that you don't have retired legislators serving. We're indicating that we are looking for citizen members, non-legislator appointed members.
Senator Ortman, are you removing the current legislator appointments?
Well, Madam Chair, the amendment still allows the Senate Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the Governor all to make their appointments. That hasn't changed here. We just are reinserting back the citizen members and designating them as non-legislator appointed members.
So the issue that Senator Bach raised is not addressed in your amendment.
Madam Chair,
because
that's
a non-legislator could be a former legislator. So you're not addressing that issue that he raised. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it depends on how you understand non-legislator members to be defined. I don't know whether that's defined in law, whether they can qualify or not. But that's how this amendment has been drafted.
Senator Bach, do you see that this would exclude former legislators or not?
Madam Chair, I don't believe this gets to what the concern is of a former legislator is not a legislator any longer. I think they're a regular citizen. So I think the problem it creates is, one, is I don't think it takes care of the problem, and two, this actually creates a board of 12 again, so now we have an even-numbered board. So I think there's two issues that are problematic with it.
Senator Bach, do you support this amendment to the amendment?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
Senator Skoy, do you support this amendment to the amendment?
Madam Chair, it doesn't seem to solve any of the issues that have been raised, so no, I do not.
Is there further discussion? Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, I understand what they're trying to accomplish. We have lots of folks that are questioning what's happening and thinking that there are ways that we can correct this, that we shouldn't be in such a hurry to add this into this bill right now, into the conformity bill, but take it back and make these corrections the way they should be made. And they were not fully discussed in Senator Tomasoni's committee yesterday. And so there are lots of questions that remain, and I don't believe that any of this should be in this bill today. You can oppose the A18 amendment, but it's not going to solve the problem that members in the Minnesota Senate don't support what's happening, not just the members of the Iron Range, but others as well, and I hope that you'll address that and consider that. This doesn't belong in this conformity bill.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam President, I'm
it's
sensitive.
It's actually Chair.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sensitive to your president yesterday.
I know. Goes back.
Madam Chair, I'm sensitive to the concerns raised, and I guess I would be willing to commit this because we actually need to move this so we can get a board constituted. If we can accomplish this and get a board constituted, I would commit to ask Senator Tomasoni to remove his bill from general orders and have it re-referred to the tax committee. And if there's a way to accomplish citizen members and not end up just a place to park former legislators, I'm certainly willing to move the Tomassoni bill later out of here, and it would pass later than this, so it would supersede anything that we do here. I'm absolutely sensitive to the concerns, but I'm not sure how we accomplish it.
Well, is there further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I'll withdraw the A18 amendment, but I will still oppose the addition of any changes to the IRRB to the conformity bill, and I'll hope
the
to follow up with
Senator
Bach
with
his promise today.
We now have the A13 amendment before us. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate file 119 in front of us.
Madam Chair.
Just a moment, please. Senator Skoy, what is your pleasure in terms of any motion?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that we will be laying Senate file 119 on the table for today. We have got House File 6 on the floor of the Senate later on today, and I wanted to have this discussion in the Tax Committee so as we move forward with House File 6, we all had an opportunity to discuss these issues in committee that we're contemplating amending into House File 6.
So, Senator Skoy, are you moving that we lay over Senate File 119?
That would be the motion.
There is no discussion. All in favor
Madam
of that
Chair,
motion,
that's not
please
correct.
Say
I had
aye.
Raised my hand.
His motion, I believe, takes precedence, but if you'd like a brief comment, we will go around the rules, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, you asked if there was discussion, and I raised my hand.
And I called on Senator Skoy, but Senator Ortman, you just go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's $15,000 per year that was appropriated for the tax incidence federal portion of the study, and I think that the spreadsheet should reflect that change. It's been appropriated going forward. And I'd like to ask Senator Skoy why it is that we're going around the rules, Madam Chair, to bring an amendment onto the House file instead of just putting this on general orders and dealing with it in the regular course of business.
Senator Skoy, fair question. Would you like to explain it again?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. And Senator Hartman, as you know, we had this bill scheduled for hearing last Thursday. We had the health exchange bill in committee, which took up the majority of the time. We did have time to receive the report, but we did not have time to thoroughly vet it. I thought rather than rushing forward on I think we had about 7 minutes left of committee time on Thursday, that it would be better to wait and do this on Thursday. The House has since acted. They passed their bill yesterday, or on Wednesday we received the report. We now have the opportunity to move this forward to help Minnesotans in a timely manner. That's the reason that we're using this mechanism as opposed to waiting till next week sometime. It's just further delay. I have had significant conversations with Commissioner Franz about the importance of moving timely on this. And so we are trying to do that as best as we can. And it appears like this is the process that accomplishes that goal.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
With the significant amendments we've made to this bill, I'm assuming you're going to move the whole bill onto the House file, but it's headed straight to a conference committee, correct?
Well, we'll see
Senator
what the
Skoy.
House decides with regard to the Senate amendments. I know Representative Lencheski had been talking about just a clean conformity bill. There was an amendment added on the House floor, so I don't know exactly if her position has changed or not in that area. We are having some discussions about other ways to move this along in a more expedited manner, and perhaps after committee, you know, we could have a chance to visit about some of those.
Is there further discussion on, well, there isn't any discussion. We've had a motion from Senator Skoy to lay the bill on the table. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion, the bill is laid on the table.
Madam Chair.
And just a second. I believe that we are not going to take up the other bills on the agenda because we have session at 11. They'll be rescheduled at some other time. Senator Buck.
Well, Madam Chair, just so the committee members understand, I'm the one that made the decision to catch the House file at the desk in order to, in a timely way, get this bill to the governor. People are filing their taxes. And I could have made a decision to allow that House file, when it came over, to take the normal course, and it would be down in this tax committee today in front of us, and we do the traditional way we do it. The problem with that is we would have then put our amendment on, we would have had to send it up to the floor and adopt the committee report from the tax committee. We could not have acted on the conformity bill today without a suspension of the rules, and I just am not sure we would have been successful accomplishing that because of the supermajority that it takes on the floor. So I really thought catching the House file was the more timely way to actually get this on the governor's desk. My hope is the House will be willing to accept some work the Senate has done and that this could be on the governor's desk tonight or tomorrow.
Senator Thompson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach, I think everybody in this room on the committee shares the concern about getting the conformity done quickly, because obviously we've got tax preparers and individuals out there that rely upon these things in order to prepare their taxes. I think the reason that I share some of the concern about the procedure is we're making this much more than a tax conformity bill. And I know many of the measures that have been put on are things that were passed last year and vetoed by the governor, but now more things are getting put on, the IRRRB stuff. And so I don't think the issue is that we disagree with you on moving a tax conformity bill. I think we all believe that's in the best interest of Minnesotans. It's just this has become an opportunity to do other things that shouldn't be rammed through in that fashion.
I believe there's no further business before the committee, and we stand adjourned.